As you know, mass customization by vertical or functional slice with a purpose-built solution that meets your audience needs is becoming the new key to success in digital media. That's why I'm so excited to welcome all of you to the launch of Twuncher, my new journalism vertical.
Actually, I'm the only person here. You probably don't need that Madonna mic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the question was, what is Twuncher? Twuncher is an emergence portfolio company with a focused approach that enables you to garner a larger share of wallet by deploying software modules tuned for the specific issues of a given vertical and piggybacking onto the Kion Wolf information brand name.
You keep saying that word, vertical. What does that mean? And how did it get to be a noun?
Well, you know, verticals are the new horizontals. I mean, who needs a horizon when you've got verticals? They're the best. I mean, everybody's really into verticals right now.
You don't know what a vertical is, do you?
No, I'm really sorry.
And yet you're launching a new vertical called Twuncher.
I just didn't want to get left behind. Ezra Klein, Nate Silver, Matt Taibbi, Glenn Greenwald, they all have verticals. I don't want to be that shabby woman at the end of the bar with her face buried in her arms and one guy is saying to the bartender she didn't do a vertical, you know?
That sounds like a bad New Yorker cartoon.
We did that show last month. My life is a bad New Yorker cartoon.
You're giving up too easily. Some verticals become relevant by pricing them at free and forcing exposure upon them, hoping market feedback will drive the new verticals toward relevancy and a market-leading position they can charge for.
Could that happen for Twuncher?
I don't know. I was randomly stringing words together.
All right, there's only one chance of figuring this out. Help me, Fulcan Flick, you're my only hope. Help me, Fulcan Flick, you're my only hope. It's not working. Where is he? Maybe he's on the show you're about to hear. And now he's still a little woozy from his Murdoch chip implant. Colin McEnroe.
What they say when they give you the chip implant is they say, this is going to feel a little cold. And it does. But then afterwards, like about an hour later, my head really started to spin. Anyway, we're going to come to that in just a second. Yes, this is The Scramble, our Monday show. The first thing we do on The Scramble is we find the most exciting person we can possibly get our hands on. And then we say to them, you tell us what the topics are. What do you want to talk about? Today, we are very excited. It's David Fulcan Flick, the Obi-Wan Kenobi of media, as you just heard. He's the media correspondent for NPR and the author of Rupert's World, The Last of the Old Media Empires, which is very fortuitous that he's a Rupert Murdoch expert. That's Rupert Murdoch. It is not, as some people thought, about Rupert Grint, the guy who played Ron Weasley or whatever his name is in the Harry Potter movies. It's about Rupert Murdoch. And Rupert Murdoch, of course, is in the news today after his hot date with Rand Paul at the Kentucky Derby. So we're going to ask some questions a little bit later with David about what such a thing means. What's the kabuki significance of something like that in Rupert's world? But before that, we've got a bunch of things that we want to run through. And first of all, David Fulcan Flick, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks. I'm still reeling and recovering from your radio theater of the air there. That's quite something. I can say, you know, you said, you know, the most exciting people, certainly one of the most available Fulcan Flicks you could find.
Yeah, we tried Marty Fulcan Flick, and he is just busy all day today. I don't know what's going on with him. But, you know, let's talk about this word vertical. I mean, one reads it in connection with the Upshot, which is the David Leonard kind of post 538 feature on the New York Times. We could read that Politico is launching three new verticals on Politico Pro, a subscription-based news service, and Vox is a vertical, and 538 is a vertical. But I got to admit, similar to the presenter that you heard in the intro, I'm not really quite sure I know what a vertical is. So could you explain that?
I feel like I've listened to too many presentations just like that one that left me similarly baffled and amused. You know, I think the general public doesn't have to worry too much about the word vertical, but it is something that journalists wrestle with. And what they're trying to do is both figure out a way to either conceptualize or make sense of what they present online and in the digital space, and also define for themselves what the heck they're trying to do. So vertical typically is that you're hiring a bunch of people and perhaps bringing in some outsiders to contribute on a specific topic that might be of interest to a shared community, but not, you know, a section of the paper. It's not that you're doing a business section of the Hartford Courant or the New York Times. It's that you're saying, We're doing a vertical on economics and personal finance, and we're going to look at it through, you know, data. We're going to look at it through government reports. We're going to look at it through representation in sitcoms. We're going to look at it through major events. And it's often not things that just happened in the last 12 hours, which is, you know, a typical definition of news perhaps. But, you know, what these things mean, what are behind them, or what are things that have been playing out over time but we simply haven't paid attention to because nobody's looked at it in a specific way.
So we've had a flurry of launches, and I'm not sure how closely the word vertical really applies to all of them. I think in some cases it really doesn't. But we've had some of the sort of the big names in digital journalism have done these launches, whether it's Nate Silver on 538 or Ezra Klein and Matt Iglesias over at Fox. And then we've got First Look coming up here, which we want to also talk about with you. But in each of these cases, you've got somebody who started out maybe sort of somewhere out there on the digital frontier, made their way into one of the more established legacy media. Ezra Klein started as a blogger, moved to the Washington Post. Now he's launching Vox. Nate Silver was doing all kinds of stuff out there in the world of more like sort of sports data crunching and stuff, and wound up with 538. That got absorbed by the New York Times. Then he left and started 538. So what are we, is there a reason that a lot of these things are happening all at the same time?
Yeah, I mean, part of the reason is that the legacy media, particularly in the form of the New York Times and the Washington Post, absorbed these guys from the outside. You know, Ezra Klein, who had been a blogger, sort of on the liberal edges of things, and who over time became so interested in policy and politics and examining it and unpacking it, particularly around healthcare and around the economy, that he was more interested in the effect he could have in helping to interpret it and less interested in sort of what partisan or ideological take he has on it, although there's still some flavor of that as well. At the New York Times, they simply bought Ezra Klein's 538 blog because at 538, you know, referring to the number of votes in the Electoral College, he took the baseball analytics approach that he had used and that he then sold off to the baseball sites and applied it to politics and did such a good job in projecting how states would play out in Senate and presidential level that the New York Times brought him in-house. And he called not only every state right in the Obama-Romney race in 2012, but every Senate race, I believe, that year. And, you know, some of those races are easy to predict, but it's, you know, as with any given Sunday in football, you're going to get one or two of them wrong, even if you're picking the favorite every time. And he really did a smart job of aggregating polls. The Times did that with Silver. The Washington Post did that with Ezra Klein. And then both of them, you know, had greater vision, greater desire, in some sense entrepreneurial, particularly on Klein's part, to try to head up his own enterprise. And he tried to seek money from the Washington Post and Jeff Bezos, its new owner, to invest in what he wanted to do. And they said, you know, if we're going to get money like that, we want to invest that in our newsroom. And for Nate Silver, he said, you know, I don't want to be pigeonholed as just a politics guy. I came up doing sports. I want to do that. I want to apply it to pop culture, and I want to do it on my own. So essentially, he went off fascinatingly and went to the wilds of Bristol, Connecticut, and got ESPN to say, we'll buy your site. So he's still inside an enormous legacy news operation, the most perhaps valuable media property in the country. But that said, he's got a lot more freedom to do what he wants, and you're seeing the Post and the Times scrambling to replace them with their own versions. At the Times, the upshot, at the Washington Post, they've hired new people to lead Wonk Blog and to create a couple other verticals as well.
You know, the question then becomes, though, just because you're good at one thing doesn't mean you're good at everything. And you think about Nate Silver, who, in all of the ways that you just said, in the 2012 election became really the most talked about person anywhere in journalism. There was this feeling that he understood something that nobody else understood. And people who really cared about the outcome of that election were making multiple visits to his page every day and talking among themselves. And he turned into one of those figures like Jackie Kennedy, who only needed a first name. What does Nate say about this? What did Nate say today? You just heard people talking that way. Now, with 538, I look at 538, his news site, which deals with all kinds of things, and it's not just sports and politics, it's culture too, it's sort of lifestyle issues, all done by sort of quants, by quantitative analysis. And to me, there's a real distinction between vital curiosity and idle curiosity. You know, you really want to know how the election's going to come out, and if it's true that Nate Silver knows better, then you really want to pay attention to Nate Silver. Do I really care what percentage of the written written source material of Game of Thrones has been used so far on the TV version of Game of Thrones. I would put that in the category of idle curiosity. So I don't really, you know, I mean, I might be kind of interested. And I just, my question, it's not one that I expect you to have to be able to answer, but my question in general to the outside world is, can Nate Silver sustain this model across as many platforms as he wants to do it?
Well, you know, I think that, or you're saying it's across as many subjects as he wants to do it. Sure, of course. You know, I think part of the question will be, are those the kinds of stories that people share on Twitter and Facebook and Tumblr and other social media platforms built for sharing, where people can discover and tumble across 538 who might not otherwise visit? You know, that might be a great thing for a Game of Thrones vertical. Mm-hmm. But, you know, am I going to go to Nate Silver every day if he's offering me stuff like that? I doubt it. You know, BuzzFeed is excellent at creating content just like that all the time. And the real question is his, you know, ability to devote analytic and data, you know, dives to such topics really going to give him much more topspin on a story or on a hit than say BuzzFeed. There may be people for whom it is a go-to site every morning, as the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal might be for more general news readers. I must say, so far, I haven't found 538 to be like that. You know, a site that has had some success along those lines, you know, is Bill Simmons over at ESPN's Grantland, which is all about the storytelling and different things. And it encompasses a world broader than sport. You know, they tell other kinds of stories at times. I think they're uneven, but they do some wonderful work. And, you know, that's brought people in part because of the voice and personality and persona of its founder and also of the talent that they brought there. But, you know, 538 is very much a work in progress. I remember very well, you know, the story Ted Koppel told and has told a number of times when he started Nightline, which was for many years really the gold standard for television news analysis and interviews, I think. And the Washington Post, Tom Shales, just killed it in his opening review. And Koppel wrote a letter back saying, "I respect your criticism. Judge us after 6 months." And Shales did, to his credit, and said, "You know, this is really a vital and interesting show." And so I want to give Silver time to find his footing. But we live not in an analog age of Ted Koppel in 1979, 1980, but the digital age of today. And people make snap judgments all the time. And I think that that's something that Silver's going to have to figure out.
You know, by contrast, I so far anyway, and this is just me and my own little prejudices, I have found myself gravitating towards Vox. And I don't even know really what the exact pretext of Vox is. But to me, what I'm getting, the way I'm reading or decoding the brand is, could be summed up in the following statement. Some assumption that you are resting your thinking about a given topic on might be wrong. Which I kind of find fascinating. In other words, you know, they'll take a look at, today Klein has a piece, basically, this is an incredibly important assumption, but he's saying, you know, it really, really isn't great to make fun of Chris Christie for being fat, and here's why. And he supplies quite a bit of interesting information and perspective on it. There's another piece on Vox. They have their own Game of Thrones-related piece, but it's that all of this boutique television that people talk about and blog about and write about and analyze isn't really watched by very many people compared to The Big Bang Theory or something like that, and numbers with that. And I'm finding that very interesting. I like having my latent assumptions exploded before my eyes. I don't know if everybody else does.
Well, you know, I think in some ways a lot of that harks back to Slate and perhaps the New Republic before it. You know, both of them publications, although they to varying degrees embrace or decline such assessments, you know, somewhat in the liberal center. But, you know, that are constantly telling their readers why they're wrong. You know, Slate, you know, there's this thing on Twitter where people do a hashtag and say Slate pitches, and it'll be something along the lines, and often offered sarcastically or ironically, say, you know, a liberal might say, you know, why the idea of actually having medical insurance when you're sick is terrible. You know, and they'd say Slate pitches because it'd be a way of saying to Republicans, no, obviously it's a fantastic thing to have. You know, Ezra Klein comes in some ways from that tradition, although he was young for it and didn't take part in those publications. And there is a lot of branding and framing of things of why you think X about Y and why you're wrong to do so. But that said, I think it, you know, at heart is an even shorter mission where they think of themselves as doing the news explained as opposed to the news broken. and they think of themselves as appealing a layer behind and say, you know, don't ask what. Everyone has what. What shows up on your homepage when you open Yahoo or Google News just instantly? Everyone knows what. What we want to know is why and how. And that's what a lot of these places are promising to answer. It's just that sometimes you don't know quite how to ask the question. And so these guys are saying, you know, data can reveal patterns or analysis can reveal underlying assumptions that lead us to flawed conclusions. And you can apply that to college admissions, as The Upshot does today in The New York Times. You can apply that to Game of Thrones. You know, everybody says it's the most popular show, but actually, you know, it's watched by far fewer people than CSI, I think, was their piece today. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I think Vox does very nicely is they have these sort of virtual post-it notes, these little white screen grabs, which explain little data points and or built-in things so that you learn about the Ukraine in just four little clicks a lot more than if you just sort of pretended to know exactly where it was and what its history was if you didn't, even though the news about it is quite immediate and quite vital.
You know, the thing that we're waiting to see, and these are all kind of sort of cheese shops or butcher shops or something like that, as opposed to a supermarket. The thing that's coming, First Look, which is backed by the guy from eBay, it sounds like, I mean, we haven't had a First Look at First Look yet, but it sounds like it's going to be a little bit more of a supermarket, right? Kind of a collection of verticals, if we're going to keep using that term.
Well, I think everything old is new again. So you got Pierre Omidyar, who's really smart about how the digital space works, one of the co-founders of eBay, and a guy who really understands how people communicate and how trust is established online because of the way in which eBay trading and sales work. He says, you know, I want to make sure there's a way to subsidize and pay for adversarial accountability, essentially investigative journalism of the kind that Glenn Greenwald and his partners at The Guardian did on the NSA over the last year. Greenwald is sort of was the first big name that he brought on to First Look. Well, what he's really doing, in my judgment, is creating a family of publications, digital publications, a lot like Time Life did in the old days, where you had, you know, Time, you had Fortune, you had Sports Illustrated, People, more, you know, in the 90s they created Entertainment Weekly and so on. And I think they're going to do that. They hired Matt Taibbi to do a kind of adversarial, I think, economics a vertical or a magazine. And they say they're going to do some publications also that will be digital magazines for entertainment and other things. But they're still thinking it through. I've talked to people who've helped to advise Omidyar and his team. I've talked to the Eric Bates, among others, one of the editor-in-chief of the project. And they're really thinking it through. They've posted some initial stories on Greenwald's vertical about, you know, which is the investigative journalism stuff, because Greenwald still has revelations to offer that he's still going through in all these millions of documents or however many he has from Edward Snowden, the former NSA contractor who gave him those documents. They don't really know what they're doing. They don't think they'll be fully launched to much later this year. But it's a different kind of enterprise that I think they're creating a family of publications there.
I have a whole other set of questions to ask you, but I'm getting a sign from the producer that we should be moving on to Rupert Murdoch. So let's do that. Maybe we can come back to that someday. Just for further thinking, what I really want to talk about at some point is, you know, as these things rise up, these new startups come, they vacuum up a whole bunch of people who've been working for kind of the middle-aged, you know, digital publications, the ones that were the early ones. So Alex Perrine is leaving Salon to go over to work with Taibbi, and Matt Iglesias leaves Slate. And you kind of wonder what's going to happen to some of those, the ones that were sort of our old favorites from the early days of the digital life. But to get your answer on that, I think we'd run out of time. We really are very lucky to have with us David Folkenflik, especially because he's the author of Rupert's World, The Last of the Old Media Empires. So we pick up the page one of the New York Times today, if we're reading it in analog form, and there's Rupert Murdoch at the Kentucky Derby as the date, basically, of Rand Paul. So as sort of a Rupert Murdoch Kremlinologist, how do you, knowing everything that you know about Rupert Murdoch, what's going on there with that little sort of showcasing of a relationship?
Well, I think that he's giving Rand Paul the opportunity to make his pitch to Rupert. I mean, Murdoch sees himself, the book's technical title, Murdoch's World, but he sees himself as kind of a kingmaker. He wants to do that, but he also wants to be perceived doing that. And the best way to do that is offer various political figures in the party the chance to make their case to him, but also make sure that others know that that's what's going on. You know, Murdoch now has a Twitter feed that also gives us a sense of where his mind's at any various moment. And in the 2012 election, there was a point at which there was real concern in Republican circles that Chris Christie's embrace of President Obama after that superstorm Sandy hit this part of the Northeast really hard, and particularly his state of New Jersey's shoreline. Christie embraces Obama. He talks about him working across partisan lines for the people of New Jersey. And Murdoch essentially starts tweeting, you know, Chris Christie was one of the earliest to support Mitt Romney publicly. Important to remind the public of that. Essentially, he's trying to snap him back in partisan line to support Mitt Romney. Now, as it turns out, Christie wasn't really among the very first to support Mitt Romney. But nonetheless, Murdoch also talked to Christie by phone. Christie called the media magnate to make sure that he said, look, this is what I'm doing. And he really does kind of vet Republican candidates. And although he flirts with supporting Democrats, he supported Hillary Clinton when she ran for re-election for Senate in 2006. And the New York Post, often vitriolic towards the Clintons, often very punishing, backed off and eased off on them beating up on Bill Clinton and questions of whether he was being perfectly faithful to his wife. You know, he can swing back and forth, and this has been very useful to him. It's useful to him ideologically, as he's a conservative at heart and really wants to see a strong, robust Republican Party. And it's also useful to him to be able to toggle back and forth a little bit between figures on the center left as well as the right, because it keeps conservatives guessing. Are they going to support him in the general election? Will he bestow support in the primary? And I think right now, you know, people talked in 2012 about the Fox primary, about the way in which Roger Ailes really served as an arbiter of who would be an appropriate candidate or the candidate of the moment on the Republican side. And Murdoch plays behind closed doors and, in this case, in full public view, such a role in all of that.
So we know what Rand Paul wants to get out of that. You just explained what Rand Paul could conceivably get out of something like that. What would Murdoch want in return? Is there an explicit relationship that he would want to have with the candidate, whether it was Jeb Bush, whether it was Rand Paul, whether it was anybody? I can get you on the phone at a moment's notice and talk to you? Is it more than that?
Oh, it's both, the ability to get people on speed dial, which he has, and also the ability to get very tangible results. I mean, in Britain, if you think about the phone hacking scandal, and this is a pattern Murdoch has followed in Australia, his native land, in the UK, where he really started making such global strides, and then here in the US as well. You know, in the UK, the hacking scandal exploded his ability to take over the largest private television enterprise called B Sky B. He actually owns 40%. He kind of runs it as though he owns it himself or through his holdings, but actually he doesn't control it. He doesn't own it outright. And he was about to get regulatory support for that from a government that he had helped to win office, the government of Prime Minister David Cameron. And in Britain, he had toggled back and forth between Labour and the Conservative Party, this currently Conservative Prime Minister, but he had supported the Conservative Party. And in turn, they were down the line going to make sure, and the private emails showed this, that he could get this win from regulators. Because of the scandal, it didn't happen. In this country, you know, time and again, he sought ways to expand his holdings, the ability of what's now called 21st Century Fox to own and operate television stations across the country. In the city of New York, where I now am, he has two television stations and he owns two newspapers. And this essentially violates federal regulations outright. He won a waiver to get past that. And yet that waiver expired and he's never bothered to get the waiver extended and he's never bothered to get the law clarified. He's just operating kind of in defiance of it. Nobody really wants to take him on because nobody wants to be pounded day after day on the front pages of his newspaper. I'll briefly say Australia in some ways the best example of this. He controls about 65-70% of daily newspaper circulation in his home country of Australia. And he had supported the Labour Party last time out. More recently, last year, he turned against the Labour Party, supported their more conservative opposition, strangely called the Liberal Party. And day after day on the front pages of his newspapers, they pounded the incumbent Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd. Well, Kevin Rudd had been supportive of what was a national broadband network that would allow the government to heavily subsidize the presentation of broadband to people around the country. And yet Murdoch had investments and business interests that would be much better helped if that was done through private industry. New government, heavily gets to office is of the belief, whether or not it's true, that they owe their election to Rupert Murdoch. Suddenly there's a lot of unraveling of previous policy that Murdoch's people could stand to gain quite a lot from. So these are very tangible things he wants to win. He wants people to feel that they owe him. And in these three very important countries in the Western world, Murdoch time and again has people, presidents and prime ministers, who think that they want him on their side.
All right. This has been fascinating. I have more questions about this, too. But that's always a good feeling when you run out of time and you still have more questions. That means we've tapped into something, an exciting load. David Folkenflik, thank you so much for joining us, media correspondent for NPR and the author of Murdoch's World, The Last of the Old Media Empires. Thanks for being with us today.
Hey, thanks to you guys.
All right. We'll be back with a conversation about smart guns, how they work and how they sort of didn't work when somebody tried to sell them in Maryland.
Who'll give him?
Well, we've been through a national gun safety debates and gun access debates. We went through a very fervent one here in Connecticut because of Newtown. One of the things that comes up from time to time is the idea of a gun that's more difficult to be fired by a stranger, by a thief, by an unsupervised child or adolescent. A gun that had some kind of mechanism on it that made it only usable by someone with a code or by the owner. And to help us understand what's going on, Stephen Tarrant is a professor at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and director of their Center for Law and the Public's Health. He's been working on this notion of smart or personalized guns for decades now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Pleased to be with you.
So in my fumbling way, I tried to explain what it is we're talking about. I'm sure you can give a better nutshell description of smart guns or personalized guns.
Well, actually, I think you did a great job in explaining it. The term smart gun means just what you said. It's a gun that will only operate for the authorized user. The gun wouldn't shoot for an unauthorized person.
And so, yeah, there are different ways of doing that. I mentioned biometric recognition. Basically, the gun actually only recognizes a certain hand it's programmed to recognize. But there are other options. There are codes that start the gun. I think there are guns that are synced up with watches, right, where you punch in the code on your watch and then the gun works.
Yes, there are guns that would use what's called radio frequency identification. And that means that the person who's authorized to use the gun wears on himself or herself either a watch or a ring or a bracelet or a pin, doesn't matter what. And that communicates with the gun. There's an antenna in the gun. And when the gun knows that it's in the hand of a person who's transmitting this signal through RFID, then the gun's going to operate. If the gun is taken away from that person, then the gun locks up and won't operate.
Now, within the last few days, we've witnessed the plight of the owner of a gun store in Rockville, Maryland, who wanted to sell one of the versions of this kind of guns. And he ran into a lot of pushback from at least one segment of the gun rights lobby, is probably even the wrong word. Why did he run into that problem?
Well, according to him, he got death threats, not only death threats against himself, but against his dog and threats that they'd burn down his business from some people. I don't think those people are representative of gun owners. And in fact, what was of greatest interest to me is when you look at his Facebook page about the people who responded to his plight, there were so many people, almost all of the people, who were pro-gun, pro-Second Amendment people who agreed with him. So his position was, why would the NRA or the National Shooting Sports Foundation, NSSF, which is right there in Connecticut, why would they object to selling a safer gun?
Well, I think the answer you'd get is that they would tell you to turn your eyes north from Andy Raymond's shop in Rockville, Maryland, towards New Jersey, where, as I understand it, they had a law that would basically create a mandate, right, that 3 years after these guns started being sold, the only kind of handgun you could buy would be that kind of handgun.
That's correct. That law has been on the books in New Jersey for a dozen years now. So once that first gun is sold, then in New Jersey, any new handgun that would be sold 3 years after would have to be a smart or personalized gun.
I mean, obviously, that does to whatever extent the gun movement is driven by certain kinds of concern about government intervention, the whole idea that their rights are going to be infringed, that is kind of waving a red flag in front of some of them anyway. What's your sense of this? As a public policy issue, how is this going to work?
Well, it makes sense to want to regulate the safety of guns. This doesn't infringe on anyone's Second Amendment rights. A person would still be able to purchase a gun, but as a consumer product, you want that gun to be as safe as any other consumer product. It's really, in my mind, no different than when we said, okay, let's put in reliable braking systems in cars, let's put in airbags, let's put in seat belts. Those things worked, and those things have saved many thousands of lives over the years. We make guns now the way we made them 100 years ago without the advantage of safety mechanisms. If we can make a gun a safer consumer product, why not do that?
Well, you're obviously preaching to the choir talking to me about this, but I think the answer that you get back is, well, you're talking about a range of consumer products. An automobile is a consumer product. We could have the same conversation about a toaster. If there was a kind of toaster that periodically burst into flames and killed all the people who owned it, it would make some sense to find a better, safer toaster and to make that kind of toaster illegal to own. But what they say is the difference between cars and toasters and everything else in the world is that and guns are that guns are in the Constitution, and we have a guaranteed right in the Constitution, which we will not knowingly allow to be infringed.
Well, the people who say that are entirely correct. The Second Amendment has been interpreted by the United States Supreme Court to mean that individuals have a right to own guns. Now, that's really most individuals have a right to own most guns, not all individuals and not all guns. But the United States Constitution doesn't say anything about whether the gun should be a dangerous gun or a safer gun. And again, we as a society make decisions where we're going to regulate products so that we're all protected from unwanted injury.
Actually, the Second Amendment also has the word that you just used in it, regulate. It's a well-regulated militia that's supposed to have these guns. Now, Stephen Tarrant, one thing that some people say when you bring up this notion of smart or personalized guns is, I don't want to be stuck with that gun because the reason I have a gun is I'm concerned about the safety of my home. I'm concerned about home invasions. I want a gun I can use immediately to repel intruders. I don't want to be looking for my gun and then the watch that has the code for the gun and the this and the that. What's your answer to that?
I appreciate that comment. I can understand why someone might want to make sure that his or her gun is going to be immediately accessible and workable. But the point is that guns nowadays really are not very reliable. Guns jam. We make guns in an old-fashioned way. Once electronics are put into guns, guns will become even more reliable. There are going to be many different kinds of technologies for personalized guns. There'll be fingerprint readers. So there's a contest that's going on right now where a billionaire in California is putting up $1 million to enhance technological ideas to make an even better smart gun. So I think that it's a specious argument that people are raising.
Has anybody tried to calculate, maybe even you, at a public health level, the impact that these guns, this kind of gun, would have incrementally? In other words, when we look at the so-called gun problem, there are some areas that would seem to be immediately addressed by this. The first one is that the guns that, through theft or other reasons, pass out of the possession of the original documented owner of the gun. So stolen guns, guns that are floating around on the black market. Presumably, those guns would not work for their illegal owners. So that obviously has all kinds of potential wave effects. And one of the other areas, obviously, I mean, a huge number of the gun deaths in this country every year are suicides. In some cases, the suicidal gun, the weapon, belongs to the person who's using it to shoot him or herself, but not always. Sometimes it's a kid. We've got, of course, the other problems with accidental deaths with kids who are messing around with guns that are not theirs. So you look at all of those. Has anybody sort of tried to come up with a number or a way of talking about the net effect of getting this technology into a larger group of gun owner hands?
With regard to homicide or assault of gun violence, That has been quantified. There are an estimated 500,000 or 500,000 guns stolen in home burglaries every year in the United States. Those guns end up in criminal hands, and as you said, if they're smart guns, they're going to be unusable by the criminals. With regard to suicide, deals with teenage suicide, where the teenager uses the gun. Conceivably, the teenager wouldn't be able to use that gun if the gun is a smart gun. There has been a study that looked at unintended gun deaths and tried to estimate what percent of those would be reduced if all guns were smart guns, and the estimate is 37% of those would be averted.
You know, in terms of the stolen guns, I feel as though I live in an age where every smart piece of coding gets hacked about, you know, an hour after it gets introduced to the world. How confident are you that smart gun technology couldn't be hacked?
Well, I'm sorry that your experience is that smart technology gets hacked. I've been luckier, I guess. For example, I have a car where I never take the key out of my pocket. The car knows that because I have the key in my pocket that I can open the locked door and I can push a button in the car and the car will start for me, but it wouldn't if you walked up to the car. We live in a world that's full of smart devices. So I think that smart devices are becoming generally available to the public. I think the public accepts them, and I think the reliability of the devices is quite high.
My last question for you. For most of my adult life, have been a real advocate of stronger gun control laws. And then watching the drama that unfolded post-Newtown, where even in Connecticut, where we did pass a stronger gun law, the net effect of that almost seemed to be, first of all, an incredible run on to gun shops on for sales of anything that was going to fall within the rubric of that gun law, including, you know, enhanced magazine sizes and all kinds of stuff. And it's just sort of arching of the collective back of gun owners and a lot of hissing from gun owners. And I started to wonder whether these kinds of legal interventions are the way to go, whether they just increase polarization and kind of remilitarize the gun ownership group. Whereas if you look over time, my understanding is over time, the actual line for gun ownership of at least one gun in America is going down. It's just going down all by itself because of probably a lot of the things that we're talking about here today. The concentration of weapons is going up. So the way that I understand it, you're the public health guy, you can correct me, is that gun ownership is going down, but the people who own guns are tending to own more and more of them. They have arsenals rather than guns. But you kind of wonder whether just through public education and conversation and discussion, more can be accomplished than a law like New Jersey's, which gets everybody all in a lather. What's your reaction to that?
I agree with you that we live in a polarized society with regard to gun policy. And once again, your understanding of prevalence of guns is entirely accurate. The number of households with guns has been going down somewhat over the years. But those households that do have guns have more guns in that household. I wish that I were more optimistic about educational interventions, that that's the way to do it, instead of having polarizing laws, as you said. But I haven't seen educational interventions work. One of the reasons is that people with guns who want to commit violence may be less amenable or vulnerable to educational interventions. I don't know that an educational intervention would have worked either on Adam Lanza or his mother, or you look at other mass shootings that have occurred over the years in the United States. And that doesn't mean we should abandon efforts to change culture or to educate people, but until we find a successful way to do that, if we can make the product safer so that we're not taking away anyone's gun, why not do that?
Sounds great to me. Stephen Tarrant, thank you so much for talking to us about this complicated but somewhat encouraging story. So, I mean, smart guns may ultimately be one of the things that, that really do help a lot. So let's hope that happens. Thanks for joining us today. We're going to go to another segment. We're going to talk about some paintings that you may have walked past 30, 40, 50 times in your life and never seen. They're by Romare Bearden, one of the greatest African-American artists, one of the greatest artists, really, of his generation. They live in a very public place in Hartford. They have to be moved right now. We'll explain all that in the next segment.
Now that Jack Bauer has to use one of those new smart guns, it's really slowing down the pace of the new season of 24. Punch in the code, shoot. Punch in the code, shoot. Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me, with help on the phones from Elton Thomas. Greg Hill appeared in the intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. Katie Tolarski is our executive producer. The part of Bill Curry was played by President David Palmer. For show pages, articles, and audio, the Faith Middleton Show staff yelling, "Chloe, I need the building schematics of every 4-star restaurant in Los Angeles. Now!" Visit our website, WNPR.org. Tomorrow, a show about black and white. And now, back to Colin.
Yeah, I don't know how we did the whole scramble without really delving into the return of 24. But we had so many things we wanted to talk about. So the final, the last egg in the scramble is about something that you may have walked by a lot of times, but I'm fairly convinced you didn't look at it. And it turns out, from the reporting of our next guest, there were people deeply connected to this building who didn't understand what they had there. Ken Goslin, business writer for the Hartford Current, now joins us. So, Ken, you've been covering the refurbishment, the changes that are going to be made to what is now called the XL Center, the Coliseum in downtown Hartford. And one of the things that you discovered was that they, the people doing the refurbishing, were just realizing they had kind of an art treasure in their midst that not many people knew about. I'll let you pick up the story from there.
Yeah, it was just about 3 weeks ago that they were, you know, kind of looking, and, you know, they knew they were going to do something to, you know, kind of enliven the concourse above where you enter through the doors. And they had these two very large pieces of art there, but there was no, they had no, you know, papers on it. And so they just started looking at it, you know, Googling it and talking to a couple of local art people, and they realized that they had two original Romare Bearden works right there.
So, first of all, before we get into that, what are they planning to do there? Are they planning a substantial reconstruction of the Civic Center or the XL Center or whatever it's called now, or are they just sort of sprucing it up?
They're more sprucing it up because the thought is that now that, you know, we want to keep it, you know, viable for 10 years, and maybe at the end of 10 years or even before that, maybe thinking about a new sports arena for the city. That hasn't really been decided, but a lot of people, including the governor, have mentioned that that may be a possibility, so that, you know, that then they would, maybe these artworks would go there at some point.
So, yeah, we should talk a little bit about this. Now, there's sort of a role reversal here because of what I was doing in 1979, 1980, I know way too much about this. So I'll kind of fill in a little backdrop here, which was that around that time, it was after the Civic Center roof fell, and the Hartford got a lot of money, $100,000 commission, some of it coming from the NEA, some of it coming from a reconstruction fund. Some other people stepped forward to kind of make up the difference. $100,000, which is a pretty big commission for an artist at that time to do a work of public art there in this building. And they sort of solicited and recruited and looked around and kind of came up with this incredible A-list of some of the greatest living artists at the time, including Romare Bearden. Although the original commission went to Saul LeWitt, who's a Hartford native. The problem with Saul LeWitt is that he was a minimalist. And so the idea that he had was these kind of concentric circles and concentric triangles and concentric squares. It was kind of a line drawing of some kind. And it was at a time when Hartford was already kind of feeling a little uppity and edgy about conceptual art because of the Stonefield sculpture, mm-hmm. the controversial Carl Andre work, which had been commissioned for, I think, about $85,000. People were already mad about that. And so there was this huge amount of pushback, and ultimately LeWitt suggested maybe splitting the commission with Bearden, and then there were still more sort of rude comments being made, and finally LeWitt got sick of it and went away. And that's how we got these two Romare Beardens that people walk by. They're sort of over the doors. People walk by them all the time and don't realize what they are. Now, so Ken, this is... It puts them in an interesting position, right? These you made some effort, and you talked to Bill Katz and some people like that who would probably have some idea of what these Beardens are actually worth. What kinds of numbers did you come up with?
Well, when I talked to Bill Katz, he had seen some studies of these collage paintings and down in New York some years ago. And those are much smaller, and those were going for $200,000 a piece, okay? Now, if you can imagine, these works are, the largest is 16 feet by 10 feet, so much larger, okay? And it's not inconceivable to him and to a couple of other people that I spoke to that it could be over $1 million that these two could be worth.
And are they technically owned by the city of Hartford? Is that who owns them?
Well, that's kind of a complicated issue. Yes, the city commissioned them. Okay, so I guess technically they'd have the ownership, but the Capital Region Development Authority, which is overseeing this renovation of now the Excel Center, has responsibility for the contents of it. So they are working with the city on what to do with these. But they're really responsible for the contents of the building.
Now, as far as we know, judging from your reporting and stuff I've seen elsewhere, the collages are in relatively good shape. Obviously, they've absorbed the fumes of a million hot dogs and various other snacks prepared in their near vicinity. They're also really big, right? And so if they're going to be trucked out of there, they actually have to – they can't go through one of the nearby doors, as I understand it.
That's correct. It's just they're too small to go directly out the street, okay? And taking apart a bank of doors that lead out to the street would be too complicated. They think it would be better to remove the doors going into the bowl, okay, which is right where these paintings sit at the Ann and Church corner, and bringing them down into the bowl and then out one of the much larger garage portal doors where, you know, stage equipment is brought in all the time. Just getting it out of the building is going to take a little bit of doing.
And then, as you reported also, then there are some questions about where this stuff can be displayed. Not that a lot of museums wouldn't like two new, well, they're not new, but two unsung Romare Beardens, mm-hmm. but these are big, you know, they need a huge amount of space to breathe in.
Mm-hmm. They are very enormous, and I know that the Capital Region Development Authority has gone to the Wadsworth. They're undergoing renovation, don't have much storage space. They really can't do it. Same New Britain Museum of Art said the same. So they're thinking that maybe one of them might be able to go over to the convention center. I mean, that's one possibility that's being talked about. Although Bill Katz, who I spoke to last week, he really feels that it should be in a truly public place, because where they are right now, even though they're a commission for it, you have to buy a ticket to get in there. You can't just go walking in there to go look at them. So his feeling is, and as with most public art, that it should be someplace where people can just go there free of charge and just look at it.
They also should not be separated. I mean, they really, I think, were meant to be in companionship with one another. One of them is sort of based on entertainment. The other one's based on sports. But they really ought to go together. It'd be kind of a shame to separate them. Listen, Ken Gosselin, so great to visit with you. And this will be an interesting thing to watch unfold. And I'm sure there's somebody at City Hall right now who's reading your coverage and thinking, $1 million, let's sell them. We've got deficits here.
Let's hope they stay in the city.
Yeah, thanks very much. All right, so we're wrapping up the scramble right here. Let me just tell you a few things. Tomorrow's show, I just want to say a word or two about tomorrow's show. The idea for the show actually started sometime last year when I first read that Alexander Payne's next movie, Nebraska, was going to be shot, had been shot in black and white, was going to be released that way. And I kind of sighed because I always sort of feel like when it's going to be in black and white, that means that some director is feeling a little pretentious or like he wants to echo the work of some past filmmaker that he admired so much, and that I'm going to have to watch this black and white movie and I'm not going to like it. Now, I turned out to be completely wrong with Nebraska. Nebraska was in black and white, should be in black and white, is a marvelous movie. I can't imagine Nebraska in color. it would wreck it. It wouldn't be the same movie at all. But why is that true? And why is it sometimes not true? And why is it also true that occasionally my Philistine prejudices are correct? Think about the movie Frances Ha, if you saw it, which really was filmmaker Noah Baumbach in an especially pretentious mood, making a black and white movie that, you know, the fact that it was in black and white really did sort of reveal all kinds of things about it and was a warning about what it was going to be like. Anyway, so we're going to have a conversation about that with the cinematographer, with a film critic. We're going to talk about the most famous black and white party ever, one of the most famous parties ever, and other issues in black and white. Thanks to everybody who helped with the scramble today.
I'm Kyone Wolf, and any second now they're going to be removing the art that I left in the Excel Center. It's in the women's bathroom, last stall, and it says, for a good time, call 860-275-7266. Any second now.